Yaakov Hebraic Congregation, Midrash on the triannual Torah portion. The verses for today, the Torah portion, is Exodus 29:1-46. The Haftorah is Isaiah 61:1-6. We are in Psalm 60, and in the Brit Hadashah is 1 Peter 2:1-25, and you can follow those along at the banner if you need them at any time. And if you have any comments, type them in text, or if you have a question, we would love to hear your voices. So at that point, we will get started with any discussion on the Torah portion in Exodus 29:1-46.
1-46, correct?
Yes.
You said 36, I think.
36, yeah, it's
so
46.
So we're going to go through verse 18 right now. All right. Shabbat shalom, y'all. This here is Mark. Eddie is out at, he's in Portland, right?
He was, yeah.
Yeah, he's in Portland, Oregon at a Restoring Israel or something like that conference, okay? And he's with Joel Bell. And a bunch of other people out there, and they're spreading the message about worldwide biblical Zionism, which we're going to hear more about. Eddie and Joel will be here on August the 2nd. I don't know if they'll be here, but they will be in North Canton anyway on August the 2nd. That's 2 weeks from today, and I believe that they're going to be here for the morning service, and we'll hear all about that then. You all will be invited to listen in at the morning service. I think that Eddie will have Joel, and Eddie and Joel will be presenting what their vision is. Anyway, so we're in Exodus chapter 29. We're going to start in verse 1 and work our way through verse 18. And it goes like this in the King James Version. And this is the thing that thou shalt do unto them to hallow them, to minister unto me in the priest's office. Take one young bullock and two rams without blemish, and unleavened bread, and cakes unleavened, tempered with oil, and wafers unleavened, anointed with oil. Of wheaten flour shalt thou make them. And thou shalt put them into one basket, and bring them in the basket with the bullock and the two rams. And Aharon and his sons thou shalt bring unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and shall wash them with water. And thou shalt take the garments, and put upon Aharon the coat, and the robe of the ephod, and the ephod, and the breastplate, and gird him with the curious girdle of the ephod. And thou shalt put the mitre upon his head, and put the holy crown upon the mitre. Then thou shalt take the anointing oil, and pour it upon his head, and anoint him. And thou shalt bring his son, and put coats upon them. And thou shalt gird them with the girdles, Aharon and his sons, and put the bonnets on them. And the priest's office shall be theirs for a perpetual statute, and thou shalt consecrate Aharon and his sons. And thou shalt cause a bullock to be brought before the tabernacle of the congregation, and Aharon and his sons shall put their hands upon the head of the bullock. And thou shalt kill the bullock before Yahweh by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And thou shalt take of the blood of the bullock and put it upon the horns of the altar with thy finger, and pour all the blood beside the bottom of the altar. And thou shalt take all of the fat that covereth the innards, and the caul that is above the liver, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is upon them, and burn them upon the altar. But the flesh of the bullock, and his skin, and his dung, shall thou burn with fire.
To listen in at the morning
camp.
Service,
it
I think that
offering.
Eddie will have Joel, and Eddie and Joel will be presenting what their vision
is. Put their hands upon the head of the ram, and thou shalt slay the ram, and thou shalt take his blood, and sprinkle it round about upon the altar. And thou shalt cut the ram in pieces, and wash the inwards of him, and his legs, and put them unto his pieces and unto his head. And thou shalt burn the whole ram upon the altar. It is a burnt offering unto Yahweh. It is a sweet savor, an offering made by fire unto Yahweh. Yahweh bless the reading of his scripture in our ears, and may we come to understand it. Are there any questions or comments on these here verses?
I know. I was curious about the curious girl until I found out it was an embroidery thing.
Reading of his writer.
I didn't realize exactly what that entailed. But all I could find, it's an embroidery piece. So. I see that everything here, it just because of what it entails, is they're without blemish, and the cakes are unleavened, and I would imagine probably the oil was probably the purest of oil, although it doesn't say that, to use in this offering that that they were going to do here. And of course it tells them how they're to dress, and they were going to be consecrated and so forth. So this to me seems like it's a pretty long ordeal, the things that they had to do. Now I think there was five of them, right? The four sons plus he that had to have this there was four sons. So everything is consecrated here. And so that's what we have through these first few verses here. And the one thing that is outstanding here says that this was done without the camp. And it is a sin offering without the camp. Does that bring to mind someone else that was also without the camp?
I think that sounds a little bit like Yeshua was.
I think
he was offered without the camp, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was outside the city.
I think Hebrews 13:11 through 13 deals with this all. And according to what says in here, Bollinger said it was an unholy camp. An unholy camp was unfit for a holy sin offering. So I'm not sure what that entails. I was trying to make out, what it talked about. I don't know. Do you understand what he's saying? He's saying an unholy camp was unfit for a holy sin offering. So are they trying to say that in the camp it was unholy because of something that was going on?
No.
That was wrong?
I don't think that Bollinger's got that right.
I'm wondering because I couldn't find
anything. I think what we're talking about is a holy camp wasn't... could not be defiled by the unholy offering being offered in it. This was the dung and stuff like that.
So it's worded wrong here.
I think the Bollinger just got it backwards.
Yeah. Okay.
He's a good man, but everybody gets his stuff wrong once in a while, except for me.
I was sort of curious because I kept thinking it didn't really make sense to me.
Yeah.
The way it was written, but if it was reversed around, then it would be
perfect as far as I'm can see anyway.
Yeah.
I'm looking at verse 4. And Aharon and his sons thou shalt bring unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and shalt wash them with water. It's interesting that they're not washing themselves with water. In Exodus chapter 19, we read it a couple of times this morning, that the children of Israel were told, go and set yourself apart and wash your clothes. Right? Well, they're not washing their clothes, and they're not washing themselves, Aaron and his sons. And that's because if they were to do that, it would signify that we could do something to justify ourselves. Okay, so Moshe, being the typical of Messiah, is the one who would have to wash them to make them clean enough so that they could come and offer the sacrifices.
I had a question. What are they washing?
Here it says, thou shalt wash them with water. It's talking about the priests themselves. And then in verse 5 it says, and thou shalt take their garments. Okay, and then later on I read something about them washing their clothes as well, and I can't remember exactly where it was. But anyway, I believe that it's Aaron or rather Moses who is doing the washing with water, and whether or not he's actually getting soap and water and scrubbing them down, I don't think. I think probably he's just pouring clean water over them, as we are washed in the water of the Word.
It could be signifying what they had when they had the bowl with the looking glass of the women, where they had to wash themselves before they went in. In a sense, it could be referring to something like that. Although this time, because they were being consecrated to Yahweh here, that someone else had to wash them, just like Mark indicated, that they couldn't do that themselves. But after that they were consecrated to him,
yes,
then they were able to go to the looking glass before they went into the tabernacle as a gesture of what had taken place prior to,
right,
to that, right?
Right. They're looking into the labor.
Right. Yeah.
And okay, and that's where they would examine themselves.
Right.
By looking into the labor.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what do they call it? The brazen sea, I think, or something like that.
Yeah. Whenever you, if you do a self-examination, then you need to look yourself in the mirror first. Then if you see the
Bill,
sin
you and
in the
I
show,
would have a hard time with that. We keep breaking mirrors, you and I.
I know that. I have. That's why I have to use one of their metal reflector mirrors. You know, I don't need 7 more years of bad luck.
Highly polished brass or silver, right?
Yeah, yeah, right.
All right, are there any other questions or comments? Anything coming off of Pal Talk over there, Phil?
Just a comment. The order of the consecration is important.
Yes, I agree that's true.
I think this is, it says led, I'm thinking head, meaning to the opening of the tent or the door, washed with the water, the word, clothed in Messiah's righteousness and the Torah and priestly garments, for we are a kingdom of priests, then anointed in the Ruach HaKodesh.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very good. Who gave you that? You didn't come up with that yourself, Phil.
Yeled Yehudi.
What was that?
Yehudi.
Yehudi gave us that. Thank you.
One thing here, Mark, it says of wheat and flour. Now, if this would have been barley, it would have been a totally different type, because that would have been a bright type, which would have been perfection. Where here, it's wheat, which is not a perfect thing. So it's shown them, you're going to be consecrated to me, but you're still not perfect yet. That's what that relays to me here. That wheat is the wheat harvest is not the perfect harvest. The barley harvest is the fruit harvest. That's the first, and the others are later on. So, to me, it's just saying, well, you're going to be consecrated to me, just like we're going to be consecrated or are consecrated to Him when we accept Yeshua. But you know what? That's not the end of it all. We're just beginning, and you're not perfect yet. You know, I mean, how many times have we said that? Well, you're born again, you have the Spirit within you. Well, you have a little bit of the Spirit, and you're not really truly born again until you get your new bodies. Then you'll truly be born again. So all we have is an inkling of what is to come and what is to be, to have that full glory.
Amen. Anybody else? I got a little bit on verse 9, where it tells us that Aaron and his sons put the bonnets on them, and the priest's office shall be theirs, for a perpetual statute. Okay? A perpetual statute. So, that thing about the priests and the priesthood not being perfect, that's true. I mean, in Hebrews chapter 7 and 8, it talks about the Melchizedek priesthood that Yeshua fills, and that being a perfect one because it's outside of time and space, okay? But that doesn't mean that the priesthood ends. The priesthood didn't end with Messiah. There's still an earthly priesthood, and we're going to see earthly priests performing priestly functions in the millennium. And we'll also see them, I think, doing that. I'm not certain of this now, but I think we're going to see them doing that also in the new heaven and new earth. I think we can make a case that there will be no sacrifices in that time, but they'll still be performing priestly functions, I think. Other questions or comments? Ron, you got your hands on a mic. Go for it.
All right. When I look at what's happening with regards to setting apart of the priesthood, it's not as though they were individuals performing just a function, but they actually became a part of the sanctuary and the whole process of what the sanctuary is all about. They're no longer of themselves. It's not like Aaron is a person. He becomes a functioning instrument of the sanctuary. His sons are no longer Nadab and Abihu and but they are those that are instruments for what the sanctuary is about. It's a tool by which we can be brought into communion with Elohim himself, with experiencing the very presence and the person of Yahweh. When we get to verse 7, it says, "You shall take the anointing oil and pour it on his head," speaking of Aaron, "and anoint him." And it reminds me there in Psalms 133, and it says, "See how good and how pleasant it is for the brothers to dwell together in unity, like the precious oil on the head running down on the beard of Aharon, running down on the collar of his robes like the dew of Hermon that comes down on the mountains of Zion, or Zion. For there Yahweh has commanded the blessing, life forever." And I believe that that's what the sanctuary and its function imparts, life forever, when we enter into fellowship with Yahweh, when we walk in his ways. This is an instrument whereby he will make a way for us to commune with him.
Are there other questions or comments? Anybody in Pal Talk? Anybody else in the room? Anybody that's here has a Bible open, you're more than welcome to pick up a mic and talk. Same with you guys out there in Pal Talk. We need to hear from as many people as we can. There's only so much knowledge in this room. Okay? There's more of it out there than there is in here. And we need to hear from you guys too.
We have a comment from KKM. It is a picture of the Ruach HaKodesh being cleansed so that the Ruach that was upon Adam and Eve may re-enter the presence of Hashem. And also, that is why the cleansing of the leper and determining if you have a disease or contacted dead flesh is such an important test.
Yeah, I don't know about the cleansing of the Ruach HaKodesh, but the Ruach of man being cleansed by the Ruach HaKodesh, I could see that. Okay. I think that you just misspoke, and I was just making sure that the semantics were correct. In verse 13, we have "Thou shalt take all of the fat that covereth the inwards, and the caul that is above the liver, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is upon them, and burn them upon the altar." I believe that this is signifying the offering of our spirits, the spiritual inward man being offered to Yahweh. And then the following verse where it says, "But the skin of the bullock, the flesh of the bullock and his skin and his dung shalt thou take without the camp and burn it with fire." It is a sin offering. Okay? And I believe that that's signifying that our flesh is not what, and the flesh of animals is not what Yahweh is looking for. He's not looking for us to sacrifice the flesh of animals, and he's not looking for us to sacrifice our own flesh. He wants a spiritual sacrifice, as he says in Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. Okay, "Present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto him, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you can prove what is that good and perfect will of Yahweh in you." So, it's the spiritual sacrifice in Romans 12 that he's talking about, that you can see here. Paul always is teaching Torah. Remember that. Paul is always teaching Torah. When he says something, you can guarantee that you're going to find something in Torah that will back it up. Okay. I'm off that soapbox now. Other questions or comments? Okay, verse 17. I have a few things here. Let's see. Verse 17. "And thou shalt cut the ram in pieces, and wash the inwards of him and his legs, and put them unto his pieces and unto his head." We're washing all the things that are inside the ram, rinsing them of any corruption, any sin that might be on them before we put it on the altar to burn it. Signification of the separation of our minds and our actions unto Yahweh. And in verse 18, we have a burnt offering. This is where Ezekiel chapters 43 through 45 talks about, I think it's 43 to 45, maybe it's 43 for 46. But it talks about the third temple, maybe the fourth temple, and the sacrifices that are going on in them. And it's talking about burnt offerings and sin offerings and things like that. But they're offerings. They are not sacrifices for our sin. Okay? And that's just to show that the priest's office is perpetual. There will always be a priest in Yahweh's temple. Got something, Bill?
When it's talking about a sweet savor here, the sweet savor in Hebrew means savor of rest. Mm-hmm. So, or the complacency or satisfaction, to be satisfied in Him. Remember back in Genesis 8, where He said they made a sweet savor to the Lord there, and He said, "I will not do thus and thus again." Let's see. And the Lord said in His heart, "I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done." So He said, you can rest assured in that. Be satisfied the fact that when Yahweh says it, that He means it and He won't do it. So this is sort of like, you know, He calms us down and cools us down. That's what the sweet savor is.
That's good. Are there any other questions or comments? Verses 1 through 18. Go for it, Ron.
Yeah, everything that's being shown here to Moshe is a type of what has happened in the heavenlies, a pattern of that which is in the heavenlies. And so, again, we're reminded that there in heaven, there is the priesthood, and that is held by Messiah Yeshua. And then, of course, the ministering seraphs and other angels that are there to minister before Yahweh. And I think that's something that we're going to be brought into a greater understanding as more of His revelation is made possible to us by the translation of our earthly bodies. But right now, we've only been able to see it through a glass dimly. But we can look upon these and recognize that there's going to be things that are even empowered and given greater insight to when the appropriate time arrives.
I failed to mention the last part of, it said it was an offering made by fire. The fire, to me, would be a fire of purification. Because any time this is made, that's what fire does. His fire, His judgment upon us, is one to purify us. So I think that goes hand in hand with the sweet savor.
Right. It's important to realize that this burnt offering has nothing to do with Pesach. It has nothing to do with Yom Kippur. There's no atonement being made here. This is a burnt offering. Burnt offerings are generally they're free will offerings, they're thanksgiving offerings, they're things like that. They're not something that's done specifically to take away sin. Okay, and that's the way that the offerings will be in the new temple in the millennium. That's right. Well, it's glory for Him. It's offering thanksgiving unto Yahweh in the way that He's designed it to be done. Any other questions or comments? We shall move on to chapter 19, verse 19 through 30. And thou shalt take the other ram, and Aharon and his sons shall put their hands upon the head of the ram. Then shalt thou kill that ram, and take of his blood, and put it upon the tip of the right ear of Aharon, and upon the tip of the right ear of his sons, and upon the thumb of their right hands, and upon the great toe of their right feet, and sprinkle the blood upon the altar round about. And thou shalt take the blood that is upon the altar, and on the anointing, and of the anointing oil, and sprinkle it upon Aharon, and upon his garments, and upon his sons, and upon their garments. And he shall be swallowed, he shall be hallowed, and his garments, and his sons' garments with him. Thou shalt... Boy, wow. Wow. Thou shalt take... Also thou shalt take of the ram the fat and the rump, and the fat that covereth the inwards, and the caul above the liver, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is upon them, and the right shoulder, for it is a ram of consecration, and one loaf of bread, and one cake of oiled bread, and one wafer out of the basket of the unleavened bread that is before Yahweh. And thou shalt put all in the hands of Aharon and in the hands of his sons, and shalt wave them for a wave offering before Yahweh. And thou shalt receive them of their hands, and burn them upon the altar for a burnt offering, for a sweet savor before Yahweh. It is an offering made by fire unto Yahweh. And thou shalt take the breast of the ram of Aharon's consecration, and wave it for a wave offering before Yahweh, and it shall be thy part. And thou shalt sanctify the breast of the wave offering, and the shoulder of the heave offering, which is waved, and which is heaved up, of the ram of consecration, even of that which is for Aharon, and of that which is for his sons. And it shall be Aharon's and his sons by a statute forever from the children of Israel, for it is an heave offering, and it shall be an heave offering for the children of Israel of the sacrifice of their peace offerings, even their heave offering unto Yahweh. The heave offering is a peace offering. Okay? That's what we get out of chapter 20, or verse 28. For it is an heave offering, it shall be an heave offering from the children of Israel of the sacrifice of their peace offerings. So peace offerings is a more general type of offering, and the heave offering is a specific peace offering. Okay, questions or comments up to verse 28?
The wave offering, I believe, was done like I were, and was done, I think, that the way that when we had our Sukkot at Clay's Park, they did it to the four corners.
Yes.
They did it to the four corners. Is that right?
You're talking about the one we did the lulav.
Yes.
Okay, yes, that was a kind of a wave offering.
Okay.
It was to four different points of the compass and then up and down, so you covered all around.
The heave offering, from my understanding, was different, and it was lifted towards heaven, and that was for Yahweh only. That's what the heave offering was for. So he really covered all bases. Now you notice it gave. Let's see. I'm trying to figure out where we're at. First, it says that he took the blood and he put it on the right ear of Aaron and upon. Lost my place again. Okay, put it on the ear, and then on the right ear of his sons, and upon the thumb, and on the great toe. So each one is emphatic because it says "and." It's doing a specific. But you see, Aaron, being the anti-type of Messiah, was lifted up. There can only be one that could be lifted up, and this was showing forth that it was done to Aaron first, and. So he was the one. Christ was so anointed and set apart on the holy mountain. If you go to 1 Peter, I think 1:16-18, I think deals with that. That he was lifted up. So Aaron, being the anti-type, would be the one that would have been higher up. Now, if you understand the doings of the cross. Really not a cross, it was a tree. And all three of them, I believe, were on the same tree. The one that was looking, there was a doctor, I was at a seminar one time, he said it could never have happened any other way because with the agony that was on them, they couldn't have been able to hear each other unless they were right next to each other. So he was faced towards the temple, lifted up above the other two, and they were underneath him, around there. So they went around to break the legs, and he had already died, had expired, so they didn't have to do that. But it does say, "Cursed is he that hangeth on a tree." So you have this being lifted up higher, and even when they do the cross, a lot of them do it right. They have that cross lifted up over the other two, so they have that part right. You see, so. The one anointed would have been lifted up, and he was. There's only one that was anointed, and the high priest was the one that was anointed like he was. The others follow suit, but they didn't have the same anointing upon them that the others had. How do we know that Yeshua was anointed? Was he not anointed with oil?
Raising something to up to the Father. What we have noticed here so far is that there are four offerings here that have been spoken of that are not for atonement in any way. Okay, we have the sin offering in verse 14. We have the burnt offering in verse 18. We have the wave offering of the in verse 24, and the heave offering in verse 28. And in verse 28 we also have a peace offering, so that's five. And I think that there are heave offerings that are involved with both the peace offering and with the burnt offering. The wave offering, the first wave offering we saw became a burnt offering, and the next heave offering we see becomes a peace offering. So we see at least four different types of offerings here. None of them having to do with atonement. None of them having to do with washing away sins. Okay? And these are the offerings, like I said before, that are going to be offered in the next temple.
Isn't that something if there's five? And the last offering was peace.
Right.
When you lift up an offering to him, he said, if I be lifted up, I draw men unto him. What comes after that? A peace. A peace that settles over you. That's a sign of war.
She's looking at the sin offering. This is in verse 14, which is referring to, of course, what would be outside the camp, which may not even occur at the same time because it would have to be a clean man that would do that. I think we read about that later, that would be able to do that and take that offering and burn it. And then, of course, you'd have to need another man because he'd have to clean himself before he came back into the camp. But that we're not talking about that right now. What I find interesting, too, is that all these different regulations are given at this time of the process of making them clean, and we'll read about it later, that they didn't even get through it. I mean, two sons were lost, even in just this process of just trying to get through this stage to the place where they would be prepared to be part of the priesthood. And because maybe the two sons had been partaking of the alcohol and didn't show respect in the proper way, they lost their lives. And so it was a grievous time. So earlier in our fellowship together here, we had a teaching with regards to the Torah and that which is coming clean before him in light of his word. And I was talking about it. And okay, I'll have to come back to that later.
Something derailed your train of thought. Are there other questions or comments here? A mind is a terrible thing to have, not have. I mean, yeah. Are there any other questions or comments up to verse 28? 28. Then let us move on. Starting in verse 29. And the holy garments of Aharon shall be his sons after him, to be anointed therein and to be consecrated in them. And that son that is priest in his stead shall put them on 7 days. When he cometh into the tabernacle of the congregation to minister in the holy place. And thou shalt take the ram of the consecration and seethe his flesh in the holy place. This is interesting. We're seething this ram's flesh. We have a Torah commandment not to seethe a kid of the goats in his mother's milk. And from this, we get the rabbinic tradition to not eat cheese with meat. Right. Or yes, dairy with meat. The fact is that it had, that specifically talks about a goat, a kid of the goats, and his mother's meat. I'm not kidding you. And Bill came up with it. I just answered him. And so that doesn't mean that you can't eat a cheeseburger, right? I mean, we need to take the word for what it says, as well as what it means in the deeper levels. But it can't go against what it says, and it's talking about a goat. Okay, so anyway, that's all I have to get right there. Here we go back to the verse 32. And Aharon and his sons shall eat the flesh of the ram and the bread that is in the basket by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And they shall eat those things wherewith the tabernacle or the atonement was made to consecrate and to sanctify them, but a stranger shall not eat thereof because they are holy. And if aught of the flesh of the consecrations or of the bread remain until the morning, then thou shalt burn the remainder with fire. It shall not be eaten because it is holy. And thus shalt thou do unto Aharon and his sons. Burn them? Wait a minute. No, it's got to be everything that he's talking about here so far. And to his sons, according to all things that I have commanded thee, 7 days shalt thou consecrate them. And thou shalt offer every day a bullock for a sin offering for atonement. And thou shalt cleanse the altar when thou hast made an atonement for it, and thou shalt anoint it to sanctify it. 7 days thou shalt make an atonement for the altar and sanctify it, and it shall be an holy, an altar most holy. Whatsoever toucheth the altar shall be holy. Got to stop here for a second. Let's just stop here at the end of verse 37. This reminds me of Yeshua talking to Pharisees, and he says, you know, you say that the altar is holy, but the offering on it, or rather, the offering is holy, but the altar isn't. He said, but it's the altar that sanctifies the offering. He says, so both are holy. Okay? And he does that with a couple of different instances. He in the same passage, he's talking about, well, you say this, but that's not it. You say something about your parents need something that you have, and you say it's Corban. It's already been promised to God. Therefore, I don't have anything to give you. Well, you know what? You're supposed to take care of your mother and father. That's your job. And when they're too old to take care of themselves, or when they need your help, you need to come to their aid because they did it for you all your life. Okay? So, not a nursing home either. That's exactly right. Actually, you know what? The inheritance was set up in such a way. Jacob had 12 sons. He was supposed to take everything that he owned and break it up into 13 pieces. And the firstborn was to get the double portion so that he could take care of the surviving parent when the first one died. That's what that was for. So when a guy says, oh, no, I've already sanctified that to God, I can't possibly take care of you with that. You know what? God doesn't like that. Doesn't like that at all. Anyway, questions or comments up to verse 38. 37.
I think what you were just referring there, Mark, is in Matthew chapter 23 and beginning at verse 18. It says, whoever swears by the altar, it does not matter, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it is bound by the oath. And he calls them fools and blind. For which is greater, the gift of the altar that sets the gift apart? See, it says, he then who swears by the altar swears by it and by all that is upon it. So they were getting it from the Torah itself, where they were making this first proclamation, but basically they made an assumption saying that, well, the altar itself wasn't set apart. But you see, there you go, as far as when they began to start developing man's rules and man's ways of interpreting. That's why we have to be careful ourselves as we dig into the Torah and begin to come to our own conclusions. We really need to be led by the Spirit and be careful of that which we proclaim.
That's right. They went either beyond Torah or they went they didn't get to Torah. This is an idea of the fences that the rabbis built around Torah. The reasoning for it was good. We want to make it so that you can't break Torah. We're going to make it so you can't get close enough to it to break it. Problem is, if you can't get close enough to it to break it, you also can't get close enough to it to keep it.
it was quoted earlier. It said, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." Let's go back. Let's go back here to 29 and then 30. He said, "After him, who? The high priest's son. The high priest's son." It says, "And that son is a priest in my stead. Hear ye him." Who is this high priest here? Yeshua. And he said, 7 days. He said, how many years? 7,000 years?
Yeah.
It says, after 7 days, he's got, it says that he would be consecrated, and which he is, and he would have on the clothing of the high priest when he comes, you see. So this is sort of like a picture, and he says, where's he going to minister at? Huh? In the holy place. Huh? He's going to minister in the holy place. Can only be Yeshua. Can't be anyone else. This is a total picture of what's going to take place in the end. Totally in the end.
You're right. It's interesting in that when he's pictured coming from Basra, you know, as a someone who's battling, he's in white garments, but yet his garments are splattered with the blood of his adversaries. And so in a similar situation where the priests themselves are, you know, clothed in these white garments, and yet they're sprinkled with the blood that they sacrificed animals. And so there is a similar appearance there. And yet it seems kind of strange, and yet you want to have a totally white, pure looking garment, yet there's these red dots all over it. You know that, I guess they do set it apart, but it's just kind of an interesting picture to see that the priest would be in this pure white garment, yet it's okay to minister with these blood splatters all over it.
How about verse 33? At one man. Oh, it does say that, doesn't it? Atonement. This is the first time in the Bible that this English word is used, because the Hebrew word is kafar. It means to cover. And where do you find this first occurrence? You go back to Genesis 6:14, where it's rendered pitch, or to cover, so that it is the only atonement that keepeth the water of judgment from us. Keeps the water of judgment from us. Because in Genesis 32:20 says, Jacob sought to appease Esau, or in the Hebrew, cover his face, to hide his offense from him. And also in Psalm 31:1, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Also it's use of the mercy seat. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Also verse 33, it says, but a stranger shall not eat thereof. Now, when it says stranger, who's it talking about? I want you to look at the context here. Aaron and his sons shall eat the flesh of the ram and the bread that is in the basket by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and they shall eat those things wherewith the atonement was made to consecrate and to sanctify them, but a stranger shall not eat them. In this case, specifically, a stranger is anybody who is not Aaron or his sons. Everyone else is a stranger. In this particular case. Okay. That's interesting. Okay, other questions or comments?
Could this also be referring to Yeshua as the high priest, and then those who are of his bride, or the overcomers, that would be given special privileges to be a part of his administration?
I would say, yeah. I would say, yeah. The priest is not just a picture of the Messiah. He's also a picture of the Messiah's bride. So, yeah, I would think that would be a...
Who's going to eat of the holy things? Is there not going to be a wedding supper? You think that'll be holy things? I think so. Is it going to take place in heaven? I don't think so. I think it's going to take place here. There'll be a special place set up that they will do this. And all this malarkey that we're hearing about everybody's gone to heaven and doing that, there's no place that I read that really is like we are told. You know, like I was indoctrinated when I was in the Baptist church, you know, that we're out of here. It doesn't say that. And I have, someone had done a picture of the wedding supper, and they showed it, a big long table and everything, but they showed it in an earthly habitation, not in a heavenly. I thought somebody had some insight to understand that and to see that. So, could that be? Yeah, I'm just sort of surmising. I don't know for a fact, you know, but I think the food that we eat, if we are His bride, then He's going to, and He's holy, the things that we eat are going to be holy things. That's probably where they get holy mackerel, but I'm not sure.
I believe they will have, yes, Tom just asked, do you think they'll have cheeseburgers? Yes, I believe they'll have cheeseburgers. I don't necessarily believe they're going to be McDonald's quarter pounders with cheese.
Well, I hope not.
But but sure, why not? I don't know. I'm just making noise. Okay. Yeah, there are, as a matter of fact, I was going to bring that up, the 7 days of atonement, at the end of which we have an eternal Sabbath. Yeah, he's exactly right. He's making intercession. As a matter of fact, our high priest, all the high priests, all the priesthood, they didn't have a Sabbath. They worked every day. Okay, because they had to bring these. They had to bring all the daily offerings every day. Yeah, the Levites for sure. So they didn't have a Sabbath. But our high priest, when he offered once his own blood, sat down at the right hand of the Father. And he's been having a Sabbath ever since. Okay, and that's a picture of the Sabbath that we're going to have.
We have a hand up from Yaled Yehudi. So, Yaled Yehudi, you can come and take the mic.
I was just going to make a comment in verse 42, depending on how your translation reads, but... you know, it's talking about the regular burnt offering, and it says at the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, for there I will meet with you, and there I will speak with you. The Hebrew is Petach Ohel Moed, which is the opening of the tent of meeting, or the door of the tent of meeting, and especially throughout the Gospels, in Yeshua's own words, John 10, for example, he describes himself as the door. And I just thought it was interesting that it's at that door, it's at Yeshua that Adonai will speak with Israel and with his people.
Well, when you're right, you're right. When you're right, you're right. There isn't anything to add to that. Very good. We have gotten through verse 37, even though Yehudi jumped ahead to 42. That's okay. Because we're going to move on if there's nothing else on up to verse 37. And that way we can kind of cover. Okay, here we go. Now this is that which thou shalt offer upon the altar. 2 rams of the first year, day by day continually. Now, it says, 2 lambs of the first year, day by day continually. This is the evening and the morning offering. Okay? And it says continually. That means forever. Does it mean that they're continually offering two lambs all day? They keep offering lambs? No, it means that they're offering 2 lambs every day. And they're going to continue offering two lambs per day forever. Okay? This is important to understand when you get down to the verse 42, 43. Anyway, here we go. Let me get there. The one lamb thou shalt offer in the morning, and the other lamb thou shalt offer at even. And with the one lamb, a tenth deal of flour, mingled with the fourth part of an hin of beaten oil, and the fourth part of an hin of wine for a drink offering. Uh-oh, another one. That makes five separate offerings. Okay? And the other lamb shalt thou offer at even, and shalt do thereto according to the meat offering of the morning, and according to the drink offering thereof, for a sweet savor, an offering made by fire unto Yahweh. This shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations. It says a continual burnt offering. Okay? This is not saying that the smoke is going to keep rising continually from whenever they light the first one until the end of time. What it says is that it says in the context that there's going to be two offerings every day. And they're going to be burnt offerings. Okay? Not that the smoke will continue to rise, but that every day there will be two burnt offerings, the morning and the evening sacrifice. Okay, continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before Yahweh, where I will meet you and speak there unto you. And there I will meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory. And I will sanctify the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar, and I will sanctify also both Aharon and his sons to minister to me in the priest's office. And I will dwell among the children of Israel. Sounds like tabernacles, doesn't it? And will be their Elohim. And they shall know that I am Yahweh, their Elohechem, I'm sorry, their God, that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. I am Yahweh Elohechem. I am Yahweh, their Elohim. So, questions or comments anywhere in the chapter of Exodus chapter 29?
We have a question that, is it true that a sacrifice was really to create a repentant heart?
Yes, it was. Not so much that it was to create a repentant heart, but to let us know why what it was that we were repenting for, I think. The idea being that the offerer was supposed to kill the animal and then give it to the priest so that the blood and the different things that had to be done to the animal would be done. But the actual slaying of the animal was done by the person who was offering it. And so you would go with your offering and you would stand before the priest and you would slice that animal's throat. And you had to do it, and you had to watch him die. And you knew that he was dying because of something that you did, or for some reason you were offering your thanks to Yahweh.
Been there, done that in our basement.
Been there, done that in your basement, huh, Bill? Okay, a lot of fun, huh? It ain't a lot of fun, is it? It is, by the way, the most humane way to kill an animal. Okay. It is absolutely the most humane way to kill an animal. And when the government steps in and says, well, I'm sorry, but which they've done in Colorado, by the way, they've said you can't kill an animal kosher in Colorado because it's cruel. It's what they said. So in order for a Jew in Colorado to get kosher meat, he has to go to Kansas or Iowa to get it. And so kosher food is extremely expensive in Colorado. Because I just came from there last week, so I just learned that last week, on last Shabbat, as a matter of fact. Anyway, go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, it brings to mind what I was wanting to bring up the time before about how when the sons of Aaron brought this particular sacrifice and this preparation before Yahweh, they had been drinking, some of the two older sons, and as a result of that, their hearts were stony. They were not made right by what they were doing, by the sacrifices and all the steps that they were to go through. And as a result of that, they offered strange fire and they lost their lives. But Yahweh's wanting us to come to that place where we have a heart that will be able to receive these things and to be able to truly respond in a way that is in accord with all that he's doing to bring us into fellowship with him, because, again, this is the purpose of what he's wanting us to see, is that he's bringing us to a place where we can have fellowship with him. And it's not these animals, it's not the ritual that's actually sanctifying all of this sanctuary. It is Yahweh's presence himself. He says, my glory will sanctify. My glory will make it right. It's just like what happened with David when he had committed murder with killing Uriah. There was the guilt that was experienced by David, and yet your sin from you. So it's by the will and by the design of Yahweh himself that the sins can be removed. So all these other things are for our admonition to be able to learn by, just as what Bill was talking about in regards to the slaying of an innocent lamb. What Mark was talking about, the various procedures of taking the life of an innocent animal and recognizing our own accountability for this innocent life. And as a result of that, we should be that much more constrained to desire the work of the Spirit that would bring us into this understanding, because we're not going to be able to fathom it by ourselves. We have to have the enlightenment of the Spirit that will even bring us to a place where we can understand the depths of our own depravity.
Let's go back to 38. It talks about day by day, continually. If you look at Hebrews 9:9, it talks about a figure for a time. In other words, but it still doesn't make one perfect. Paraphrasing like Hebrews 10:1-2, it says, "Does the law?" In other words, the question I would ask: does the law being a shadow of good things to come, by these sacrifice make one perfect? And if so, then why would they have been offered day by day? Right. For this is what Yeshua did, once for all and for all time. That's the difference, the sacrifice. He was the more excellent sacrifice that was offered.
And with that, though, speaking of the lamb being sacrificed here twice a day, and that he would be the lamb, but yet Yeshua being with them continually. And again, an example that Yeshua is in their midst, since he is also a lamb. And then the thought of going back to what I believe Eddie shared a couple weeks ago, that since the children of Israel, while Moses was up on the mount, decided to defile themselves by worshiping the golden calf, if I've got this straight or somewhat straight, that now these different regulations or laws are given for the tabernacle, that it's Yahweh's gracious way of saying, even as Ronald pointed out, that Yahweh would be in their midst, and since they were afraid of him, but he's making a way to be able to have his presence with them, and in a sense, as time goes by, they will be getting to know him more and more by doing these different activities.
Other questions or comments? Anything coming off of Pell Talk, Phil? Not right now? Okay. Other questions or comments on the Torah portion? Didn't even break out the Chumash today because I didn't have a chance to read it. So, Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 through 6 is our Haftarah for today. And there it says, "The Spirit of Adonai Yahweh is upon me, because Yahweh hath appointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of Yahweh, and the day of vengeance of our Elohim, to comfort all that mourn, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness, that they might be called trees of righteousness, the planting of Yahweh, that he might be glorified. And they shall build the old wastes. They shall raise up the former desolations. They shall repair the waste cities, the desolations of many generations. And strangers shall stand and feed their flocks, feed your flocks, and the sons of the alien shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers. But ye shall be named the priests of Yahweh. Men shall call you the ministers of our Elohim. Ye shall eat the riches of the Gentiles, and in their glory shall ye boast yourselves. What a day, what a day, what a day that will be. Let's. Any questions or comments on verses 1 through 6?
Anointed here. I believe that this is the divine formula of consecration. He said, this is my son. He also said it was for the office of what? First a prophet in Matthew 17:5, for the office of a priest in Psalm 2:7, and Hebrews 1:5 for the office of a king. So you had all of these things that he was consecrated for, and that he would become as he moved along and as time comes. But the last part that hasn't been fulfilled is coming as the king.
Potentate.
The potentate that's going to come. I think notice in verse 2 it says the acceptable year, and it says, and the day of vengeance. The acceptable year is the Jubilee year, mentioned in Leviticus 25:9-10, but a day of vengeance for Yahweh is in Isaiah 59:17. 63:4 says, for the day of the vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. Both are connected. They're basically the same thing. It could happen like this. I remember years ago, Eddie and I were talking about the trumpet sounding. One trumpet sounding and another trumpet sounding. One's going to end, one's going to start. You see? So basically, I believe that this is what this is going to be. It's the year of Jubilee for some, and it's going to be a year of vengeance for others. You see? At least that's what I see from connecting the two together here. When Yeshua stood up in the synagogue, he taught part of this.
Finished in the middle of verse 2,
and he didn't give the last part, the day of vengeance. He talked about the acceptable year of Elohim, because that's when it started. How long has that acceptable year lasted? 2,000 years now, you see. And then that day will come, but they are all connected here. So part of it deals with the pouring out of the Ruach to the people so that they might be able to accept him. And then the last half deals with that dreadful day, which is to come soon. Very soon it's coming.
That's right. Well, yeah, verse 4 on is pretty cool. They shall build the old waste places. They shall raise up the former desolations. They shall repair the waste cities and desolations of many generations. Of many generations. That's interesting. You know what? When they went into Babylonian captivity and they came back, that was not a fulfillment of this prophecy. Couldn't be, because they weren't there for many generations. They were there for not more than two. And they shall build the old waste places. Okay, and strangers shall stand and feed your flocks, and the sons of the alien shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers. Okay. Verse 4, they shall build. May deal with
I can't read my own writing.
That's restoration.
it's getting harder and harder all the time. I'll tell you what. I'm going to have to. Anyway, go ahead. I'll decipher this thing and figure it all out. Anybody else got anything to?
There's a well-known preacher today in charismatic movements. I'm not going to mention his name, but he's from around Columbus, Ohio. He has a book out, repairing the breach or the old waste places. But it doesn't say that we're going to do that. It says they, meaning those who are going to be under those that are going to be his bride and those that's going to serve him. So that biblically can't be right, what he was teaching there. And I don't know that if he saw that, because you gotta look at the word they and they, you see, to get the understanding of what's taking place here. In other words, they're going to be doing all the work. That's what it says.
From verse 2 on, you have various types of blessings that will be given to those for having gone through a time of suffering, for those that mourn, for those that have, you know, this ashes. And we're looking at similar in garments. We're looking at what was happening for the priesthood, just a little bit back there in Exodus chapter 29. And I think we're seeing the same thing. We're seeing a preparation, or at least the result of having gone through a time of sanctification. And so it is for us, as it was for the priests. We're going to receive garments that are going to be even better than the garments that were those that were sprinkled by the blood that had been prepared according to the pattern that was given to them, given to Moshe on the mountain. And we talk about those sacrifices and how they have a significant meaning. And I don't think we understand, like I said before, we understand the significance of each one of those, the wave, the heave. I mean, yes, they have an understanding in the context in which they're given, and you can interpret as far as the significant purpose that they have. But as far as even how we are going to be fulfilling it as our sanctification proceeds through our lifetime, that we will be going through times of mourning, times of experiencing the ashes of life, of our dreams being burned up before us, that were not really dreams that were that essential, but they were things that we wanted or desired because we perceived them to be good or to our benefit. But in Yahweh's wisdom, He allowed them to be consumed on His altar so that they could bring forth something even better, embellishments of His type. Oils of His joy, garments of praise, that we might be called trees of righteousness, you know, the planting of Yahweh, that to be adorned, that we might be glorified. So having gone through this setting apart by going through loss, learning obedience to the things that we will suffer, through the groanings that we will offer up as intercessors on behalf of our brethren and of those that will recognize the grave difficulties that we are entering into as we go into Jacob's trouble, into the time of tribulation and persecution, the time of being turned over to an adversarial system, but yet realizing that even in the midst of that, His eye is upon us, and He's promised that He will never leave us or forsake us, that in the midst of that we are going to be experiencing a cleansing, a sanctification. And it's a fearful thing to know that we're in the hands of the all-powerful Elohim, but yet it's a comforting thing as well.
It talks about the trees of righteousness here. I think if you went to the chapter preceding chapter in verse 21, it says, "Thy people also shall be all righteous. They shall inherit the land forever, the branch of my planting, the work of my hands, that I may be glorified." We have to remember that everything that is done to edify us, to help us, is for His glory, not for us. Everything goes back to Him. When you receive the crowns, who do you lay them at? You lay them at Messiah's feet. And there's a song that says about, must we go in empty-handed?
We don't have to go in empty-handed if we follow Torah. He will give unto us those things as the deeds are done in the body.
Okay, you know how I like to see progressions and groups of things. Well, it's just one of the things that I've been trained to look at. But in verses 1 and 2, in verse 1, he speaks of five different groups who are different types of exiles. Okay? He has the meek, the brokenhearted, captives, them that are bound. Okay? Preach good tidings unto the meek, send me to bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to the captives, opening the prison to them that are bound, proclaim an acceptable year of the Lord. Then it's like verse 2, the first two phrases in verse 2, or first two clauses are like a comma or a how would you call it? It's a completely dependent clause, but it's independent of the, I don't know how to put it. Anyway, it's independent of verse 1 and from verse 2c and following. And then verse 2c talks about to comfort all them that mourn. Okay, this is after the vengeance, the day of vengeance of God. To comfort all them that mourn, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give them beauty for ashes, oil of joy for mourning, garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness. Okay, so they get those three things. That they might be called trees of righteousness, planting of Yahweh, that he might be glorified. Okay? And they, that's all these people who have been comforted from their mourning, that have been appointed, that have been given beauty for ashes, the oil of joy, they're called the trees of righteousness, the planting of Yahweh, they shall build the old waste places, they shall raise up the former desolations, they shall repair the waste cities and desolations of many generations. And the strangers are taking care of their flocks and tending their gardens while they're doing all these things, building the old waste places and raising up the former things. Okay? It's really interesting when you watch how the sentence structure works, which is really hard to follow in the King James, because there's all it was punctuated by a guy on camelback, and the camel had like two short legs, you know. And does that one belong there? I don't know. Does that one belong there? Well, you know what? If you read through there and you understand what colons and semicolons and commas are about, yeah, it makes perfect sense. This is all like one big sentence. And it talks about completely different things that are related. Yeah. So it's important to try to understand this stuff. It is all these people that are mourning, all the people that he preached to before, are the same people who are going to be delivered after the day of vengeance, and they're the ones that are going to build up all the waste places. It's way cool. Yeah, and for your shame, you shall have double. Yeah. So, other questions or comments? Hope I didn't confuse you thoroughly with that last.
Yes, in regards to the first verse of chapter 61 of Yeshayahu, when Yeshua proclaimed this, I'm sure that much of what he was saying was going out and being broadcast to the peoples. And now, it wasn't long after Yeshua began to minister that John was put in prison. And so, John knew this verse, and he may have even heard that Yeshua had spoke this verse. And so he's thinking to himself, proclaim release to the captives, and opening of the prison to those who are bound. He's thinking to himself, what am I doing here in prison? Isn't this one of the promises that the Messiah is supposed to bring? Is to set people that are in prison, to set them at liberty? And so he sends word through his disciples to Messiah and says, are you the one, or should we look for another? And Yeshua at that time began to heal those who were coming with various types of diseases. And then he gave this word to the disciples of John. Go and tell John that, you know, the blind are healed, the deaf are made to hear, and that the good news is being proclaimed. But he didn't mention at all about being set free from the prisons. And so there was a setting aside in part, just as he didn't complete the second sentence, but he had a portion that he was doing at that time. But because of the hardness of the hearts of the people in receiving the ministry of what he was bringing to them, then there was a setting aside of the fullness of what was to take place. And so the opening of the prison wasn't to take place, at least for John at that time. Though there is a setting free from the prison of sin. And that's what Yeshua came to do in regards to setting us free from the captivity that we had in regards to sin having power over us. He broke that particular hold upon our lives through his death and resurrection. And I think at that time, even John wasn't totally understanding of all that Yeshua had come to do and to bring about and to fulfill.
Actually, sin does still have power over us if we give it up.
Right.
Oh, okay.
It power.
But it's not sin's right to have power over us anymore. We have to relinquish it.
Be disobedient.
Okay. Kind of the same thing we were talking about with the political situation. I mean, they try to take away rights and they try to guilt us into. They pass 85 miles of laws on the shelves of the Library of Congress, and they pass the laws specifically to make us feel guilty. Okay, because somewhere in that 85 miles of laws, I'm probably breaking 3 or 4 of them right now, just standing here breathing. You know, so I mean, the idea behind all those laws is to make us guilty. The freedom that we have in the Torah. If we allow ourselves to be governed by only the spirit of Elohim and the 613 laws that he gives us. Do you understand what kind of freedom that is? And how little there is to be guilty of? You know? So, yeah, Satan's system is designed to make us feel guilty. We were talking about this Thursday, weren't we? Yeah. Anyway, go ahead, Bill.
Since we're talking about bound, I hope I'm not out of bounds here on this. When we are captured in the bodies that we have, so we are bound in these physical bodies that we have, and he's going to set us free from that. But the other thing. To them that are bound. Well, who are them that were bound? Jacob is bound because he doesn't understand Torah. And Judah is bound because he doesn't know Messiah. And that's going to be broken.
Right. You said Jacob. You meant Ephraim.
Correct? Ephraim.
Okay. Thank you.
So you have both aspects of it here, the spiritual and the physical.
Exactly. It says in Romans chapter 9, I believe, Paul says that blindness has been put on them in part. But you know what? Blindness has been put on Ephraim in part as well. Okay? Yeah, they don't see Messiah. Ephraim in general doesn't see Torah. And we need to have both.
Now Mark was talking about groupings in the last, verses 4, 5, and 6, you see there's definitely a grouping in regards to different dispensations or different callings that different ones will attain onto because of the work of Messiah in their lives, in the work of the Spirit, and in their obedience and walking in the ways of Torah, that there are going to be those that will be priests of Yahweh, servants of our Elohim, shall be said of you. and they'll consume the strength of Gentiles and boast in their esteem and their glory. This is what we're going to be given. Just as Aaron was given a perpetual office and his sons, so we, if we walk in that righteousness, the sons of Zadok, sons of righteousness, we will be given a perpetual place before him in his government, and we will rule and reign with him. So this is something that we have as a promise, that's something you could take to the bank. You know, continue to put this on deposit in your heart and remind yourself that this is for you. This is for me. If we choose to continue to walk in His Torah and be obedient to the leading of the Spirit.
Other questions or comments?
Go. It's pretty good in here. In the commentary, it talks about desolations, places of silence. What are places of silence today? The church. The churches are places of silence.
Yes, they are. There's very little warning going out from the churches.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
Places of silence are any places that refuse truth. If truth is not going to have a place, it's not going to be received, it's going to be eclipsed, well then, that's a place of silence.
Last night, it was late, and I'm tired because I sat up and watched it. But there was a movie on the TV. It was 1947's Academy Award winner for Best Picture. It was called Gentleman's Agreement. Great movie, isn't it? I mean, kind of melodramatic, you know, it was a 1947 movie, you know. But anyway, the story is about a guy, a Gentile, author. He writes newspaper and magazine articles, and in specifically he's an investigative reporter, okay, for lack of a better term. He would figure out a story that he wanted to do, and then he would go and live the story, and that way he could write about it from firsthand knowledge. Well, here's this Gentile, and he wants to write a story on anti-Semitism. What better way to understand anti-Semitism than to become a Jew in 1947 America? Okay? Oh, it's a great movie. It really is a great movie. There's a love story and all that, and he falls in love with the girl, and the girl ends up being not an anti-Semite, but a typical Gentile who is not an anti-Semite. Somebody who will stand back and watch and allow the prejudice against Jews or anyone else to go on. And that's the premise of the story, is this prejudice against Jews. It's extended to blacks. It's also extended to Asians and anybody else. It says anybody if they call a Jew a kike and you don't do anything about it, you're just as bad as they are because you're not stopping it. Okay, it's just like the German people and Hitler killing all the Jews and the German people knowing what was going on. It's just like the abortionist and the Christian church or the messianic fellowships not going out and raising a big stink about it, telling them that they're doing wrong. Okay? It's about watchmen not being watchmen. Okay? And that's the whole story of this movie, Gentleman's Agreement. 1947 Academy Award winner Gregory Peck. Great.
There's also a book, isn't it called Black Boy? He did something similar.
Yeah, there's one called Black Like Me. The guy did exactly the same idea. Yeah. He took pigmentation into his body, and he became black to sight, and how people changed, how people's reactions to him changed. This guy in the movie last night, he just lets loose that. You know, and I'm not saying this just because I'm Jewish too. Okay, and he said that in a board meeting at this place. 5 minutes after the board meeting was over.
He was
gone. No, he wasn't gone. He wasn't gone because everybody knew that his publisher knew what was going on. But 5 minutes, everybody in the place knew that he was a Jew. And they treated him differently, including the Jewish woman who worked for him as his secretary. and said, "Oh, you don't want to hire. You don't want to hire just any Jew. I mean, what if they're too kikey?" She literally said, "What if they're too kikey? They're too much like New York Jews. The typical idea of what a New York Jew is like. Okay, loud and boisterous." And she, and this is what she said. You know, they're too loud, and they, you know, they. You don't want people like that working here, do you? And this is a Jewish woman who's talking this way. And you know what? Everybody in this thing was played by a Jew. So, except for the Gentile author's best friend, was played by John Garfield, and John Garfield was a Gentile playing a Jew in this movie. His name was Goldman or Goldberg or something like that in this movie. Okay, so it was a really, really well done movie. Although, you know, it was 1947 acting, it was a little bit stilted, but really a good movie though.
We have a comment from Yaled Yehudi. So, Yaled Yehudi, speak up, please, and you can have the mic, Yaled Yehudi.
Actually, back to Isaiah 61, verse 2, I just had a question. I'd kind of like to hear some additional comments or explanation about exactly what the acceptable year of Yahweh is, the day of vengeance of our Elohim, and what people think about what those two events or times are and how they might be related.
I think they're related because this Isaiah 61 is talking about Messiah's ministry on earth. And I believe that it shows us where the separation is between his first and second coming is right there in the middle of verse 2. The acceptable year of Elohim means that, hey, you know what, everyone can come to me. Now, this is the acceptable year. This is the acceptable time. Now is the day of salvation. And he stopped there because that's what we've had for the last 2,000 years. Now is the day of salvation. It begins again with, and the day of vengeance of our Elohim, which doesn't happen until the middle of the tribulation period, if that's the way it works, or at the I believe the beginning of what Revelation would call the trumpet judgments, or the vial judgments. That's the real day of vengeance of Elohim, is when those vials are poured out and all the wrath of God comes down. See, all the wrath of God isn't coming down right now. When we see God's wrath in things like forest fires in California, this is God's mercy, not his wrathful judgment. This is a judgment of mercy where he's trying to get our attention. This is still the acceptable year of Yahweh. But the time is coming very shortly when the day of vengeance of our Elohim is going to come. Okay, so, and the vengeance of Elohim is also a gracious and merciful thing. Because even in his vengeance, he's going to bring the judgment quickly. And it will be as mercifully administered as possible.
So what you're saying then is from the time of Messiah Yeshua has been an acceptable year. Just as he said, today is the day of salvation.
Right.
Now is the acceptable time.
Right.
So from then till now, to today, we have the acceptable year. But the day of vengeance is spoken of by Joel, and speaking of when he shall bring upon his wrath upon the world.
Yes.
Now, I'm going to read it. I think I read this before. And I'm not sure that if Yehuda didn't catch us, but it says in Isaiah 63:4, it says, "For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come." The year of my redeemed is Jubilee. And vengeance is part of that. In other words, they go hand in hand. They are connected. You're going to be parted on the left hand. You're going to be parted on the right hand. You're going to have that Jubilee period, but you're also going to have a time of vengeance upon those who have not followed after him. So basically, they're one and the same. they're connected, but they're not connected.
Yes, the Day of Vengeance is that which takes place just before the actual Yovel. Okay. So what happens is that the Day of Vengeance is, the way that I understand it anyway, is the days of awe, the 10 days when judgment will be coming upon the earth fast and furious, and that will end with the Day of Atonement. And the Day of Atonement that year will also be the last of the 120 Yovels, the 6,000 years, the Jubilee. Hopefully that answers the question. Correct. But there, he asked about the connection. There is a connection between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I think that's what we were getting at there.
We have a follow-up question from Yeled Yehudi, so you can come and take the mic. Yeled Yehudi.
Thanks. Actually, Bate, yeah, that answered the question quite well. As I was reading it, I found something else, and I'm not sure, maybe you guys saw this before, but I was actually looking at the Hebrew, and, you know, the Hebrew word for year is shana, like in shana tova, you know, happy new year, all that. But when you look at both 61:2 and the verse that the other brother quoted, 63:4, that word in Hebrew is actually plural. It's shanat. So that actually fits right in with what you were saying, Bate, in terms of, you know, from the time that Messiah came till now and until, you know, the Day of Judgment, it's actually years. And I just thought that was pretty cool.
Thank you, bro. Appreciate that. You did good. Have we got any other questions or comments on Isaiah 61, verses 1 through 6? I'm looking around. I'm not seeing any hands reaching for mics. You can. I saw you almost, Susie. I saw you. If you want to. No? Okay.
No, it was me.
Oh, that was you. Oh, she was swatting your hand away. Is that what was going on there? Oh, okay. Then let's move on to Psalm 60. Psalm 60. Before I get there, this says, to the chief musician upon Shushan Edut, Miktam of David, to teach. When he strove with Aram Naharaim and with Aram Zobah, when Joab returned and smote of Edom in the Valley of Salt 12,000. If you'll think about that for just a minute, this was David's reply to Yahweh's protection, because what this was, Aram Naharaim and Aram Zobah, Joab was just coming back from having a big battle. They were very, very tired. The Assyrians, this took place when all the kings of the east and north allied against David to kill him, and when he was at his weakest militarily, which was a good plan, if Yahweh were not his rock, okay, if he was not Yahweh, his David's defense and his strength. And what happened was that the Assyrians literally came to the aid of Moab and Edom, and they were coming to fight with David at the time when he was weakest. The nations, the 10 northern tribes had just joined up with him, and it was as a result of a battle that had happened between Joab and
Abner.
Yes. And I don't remember. I don't remember exactly. I'm taking this out of memory. So I'm taking this out of memory, folks, so it may not be exactly correct. But anyway, Assyria was an up-and-coming province at the time. They were an up-and-coming kingdom, and they were very powerful. And so Moab and Edom went to them to get help. And so Assyria came to give them help. And Joab turned. This is where Joab and the other guy were. He said, you fight them that way, and I'll fight them this way. And if they get too strong for you, then I'm going to come and help you. And if they're too strong for me, then you'll come and help me. Right? His brother. Exactly. And so they went into the fight, and Yahweh was on Israel's side and wiped out the Assyrians. And we never heard of Assyria again until it was like 250 or 300 years. It took them that long to build their forces enough so that they could come against the northern tribe. They wouldn't dare come against Judah, because they learned that lesson.
I have a subtitle for this psalm. I put above it, don't be weary in well-doing.
Amen. Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? Okay, so here we go. Psalm 60. Oh, Elohim, thou hast cast us off. Thou hast scattered us. Thou hast been displeased. Oh, turn thyself to us again. Thou hast made the earth to tremble. Thou hast broken it. Heal the breaches thereof, for it shaketh. Thou hast showed thy people hard things. Thou hast made us to drink the wine of astonishment. Thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth. Selah. Stop and think about that for a minute. You have given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth. That my beloved may be delivered, save with thy right hand and hear me. Elohim hath spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem and mete out the valley of Sukkot. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver. Moab is my washpot. Over Edom will I cast out my shoe. Philistia, triumph thou because of me. Who will bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? Wilt not thou, O God, which has cast us off, and thou, O Elohim, which didst not go out with our armies? Give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man. Through Elohim we shall do valiantly, for he it is that shall tread down our enemies. David is looking at destruction from Assyria and Moab and Edom, because the forces arrayed against him are so great. He's looking at destruction. What does he do? He takes ownership of Israel's sins. He admits that they are sinners. He comes to Elohim and he asks for mercy. He repents of the sins and he asks for mercy. And Elohim delivered greatly. That's just fascinating to me. Now, if there are questions or comments on specifics in this, go for it. Anybody got anything?
Through this whole thing in the army, the 22,000, whatever, that David's army was against Syria and so forth, and those against Edom, it just proves that if you're on Yahweh's side, then you can defeat the foe. But you've got to be on his side. And the only way I know that you can be on his side is if you are strong in Torah and doing the best to keep it. Was he dismayed? Yeah, because he has a human nature. And he saw what was happening. And he was the go-between between the people. He was the high priest here. He was acting the high priest here, to show forth that yes, we have sinned, yes, we have done this, and these things are happening here. And he stopped right there and he said, now let's consider this.
Let's consider this. Then he goes in, that thy beloved may be delivered. Who's the beloved? Israel. It's his beloved. So, and he goes on, he tells him what it is. And he tells him the strength of Ephraim and Judah and so forth. And he gives Manasseh, he says, all these are mine. Whose really are they? They're Yahweh's. They're Yahweh's. So you see, if a sin comes and we repent of that sin, regardless of what the sin is, we can be forgiven. Doesn't necessarily mean that we're not going to have to pay for that sin, you see, because we do. We do pay for it. But in this instance, David was being the high priest here. And who gets the glory? Yahweh. Yahweh gets the glory again. But if this is an exile and redemption.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can see the two houses here very easily in verses 6 through 8. We see the Shechem and Sukkot and Gilead and Manasseh and Ephraim and Judah, my lawgiver. And you can see the tributaries, Moab and Edom, Philistia. I mean,
the washpot is a
foot bath. That's right. But you can see the two houses here very easily. This, by the way, when it happened in David's day, it was a partial fulfillment of this prophecy. But the ultimate fulfillment is yet future, and we're going to see that when Yeshua is reigning on his throne in Jerusalem.
In verse 4 it says, the end of the verse, because of truth. Think upon that, because of truth. Time and again, David recognizes the character and nature of Elohim, that the glory goes to him, that the honor of his integrity in regards to his willingness to help his people, willingness to help those who will humble themselves before him, is to be lifted up. He even said that the world may know when it came against Goliath. And it's not unlike that, in that it seemed as though the armies of Israel were overwhelmed. And in that situation, even though it looked as though he was no match for this huge giant, yet he recognized that the strength was not in himself, but the strength was in Elohim. And so that the world may know, he would come against this giant, and that the giant would be defeated, and he would turn over the carcass to the birds of the air, and he would make an open show of this particular adversary because of what would happen when Elohim would go before him and would defeat his adversary. And so it was in this particular situation a similar circumstance, and he knew that his Elohim was more than able to intercede and to make the situation turn to their advantage. But it was important that he, of course, recognize the adversary, and that their own condition was such that they needed to walk in humility of heart, that they needed to recognize where their strength came from.
If we understand that truth, because we've had that this morning, class, truth is Torah.
Right.
Is it not? So if we read this, that it may be displayed because of Torah. Because of Torah. If you keep it, because of Torah, I will do these things for you. And he says, thy right hand. Doesn't say the left hand. Says the right hand, which is the right hand of blessing. The left hand would be used against them as judgment. So the blessing was in the right hand, and that's what he was hoping for, that blessing. And he was very adamant here, too, because he's telling them, I will rejoice before it ever happened. He believed it before it happened. These things were going to take place, and they did. And Yah, again, received all the glory.
Well, verse 10 reminds me of when Moshe said to Yahweh, when Yahweh told him that my presence does not go with you. And Moshe said, if your presence doesn't go with us, you know, we're done for. And I think David is saying here, I know you will go, but we really, really, really do need you, and we are depending on you. And so If you don't go, no one else will help us. So it has to be you.
Okay, go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, verse 7 says, Yehuda is my lawgiver. Well, wait a second. I thought Moshe was the one that gave the laws, and yet here it says, Yehuda is my lawgiver.
But wait a minute.
Then,
go ahead. I got a feeling I know where you're going. Go ahead.
I'm going here to James now, or Yaakov, in chapter 4 and verse 12.
No.
Where it says, there is one lawgiver and judge who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another? So who's that one lawgiver? It's Yeshua. And who is, which tribe does he come from? The tribe of Yehuda.
I don't get it. Yeah, that was outstanding, yeah. Very, very well done. Very well done, Ron. Anybody else? Anybody else? Psalm 60. Anybody in Pal Talk, Phil? Then we're moving to 1 Peter, chapter 2, whole chapter. Brit Hadashah portion. Guess why they picked this particular chapter? Because it talks about the royal priesthood. It do. And by the way, that's why they picked... Well, actually, they didn't pick Psalm 60. It just falls out that way. You know? I mean, we're reading through the Torah portion, and this is the 60th... Actually, it's like the... Let's see, this is week 16, I think. Or 17. Okay, the end of 15? Okay. Okay, so it's week 15 of the second year, which means that it's been... This is the 67th week through this triennial Torah, right? And that was the 60th... I mean, we just take the Psalms as they come, and then we skip Psalm every once in a while. So it comes out. I don't know how it works out, but we're talking about the priesthood in Exodus. We pick the priesthood in the Haftarah. Then the Psalm just happens to fall out, and it talks about David sitting in the seat of the high priest at that particular time. And of course, they choose the Brit Hadashah portion. They choose the Haftarah portion, but so that it goes with the Torah. But it never fails to amaze me that the Psalm fits the Torah portion, and they're just ones that you know they just come as they come. Anyway, yeah, it's amazing how Yah works that out, isn't it? Anyway, here we go, chapter 2 of 2 Peter, and we'll read. Let's see, how many verses are there? 25. Do we have a page? No paragraph break. Okay, so we'll just read the whole thing. Wherefore, whenever you see a wherefore, look to see what it's there for. Okay? But the word of the Lord endureth forever, and this is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. That's the last verse of chapter 1. The end of chapter 1. The last verse of chapter 1. By 1 Peter. By the word of the Lord endureth forever, and this is the word which by the gospel is preached unto you. Wherefore, laying aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisies and envies and all evil speakings, as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word, that ye may grow thereby. If so be, ye have tasted that Yahweh is gracious. Now, before I go any further, as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word, that ye may grow thereby. Do you know how quickly babies grow? I mean, if you think about it for just a second, have you ever seen a calf born? Okay? And immediately it goes for some milk. And cow's milk is made specifically to make little calves into great big cows quickly. Okay? And a human mother's milk is meant to make that, to give that baby everything it needs, all of the things that it needs to be nourished, and so that it can grow very quickly. And babies grow very quickly. Mine did anyway.
They went from 8 pounds to 16 pounds in 6 weeks. They went from 16 pounds to about 25 pounds by the time they were 6 months old. And then they kind of leveled off and they stayed that way until they were three. But 25-pound kids at 6 months, okay? We're talking big kids. They grew fast. Okay, and that's because they were mainly fed milk. Okay, so it's important that newborn babes eat, drink milk. Okay, it's not important that they eat meat. Therefore, when you get somebody who has just been saved, you do not give them the Gospel of John, because that is really tough meat. Why do people do that? Start them at the beginning. It's the best thing to do. In the beginning, did God create the heaven and the earth? And let them read the Torah as it comes, okay? Because Yahweh gives us more information as we go. He gives us the simple stuff first, and you know, I'll tell you what. Genesis 1:1 can be very deep, but it's the best place to start somebody who's new. Not John chapter 1 and verse 1. Okay, because they're never going to understand the Memra. They're never going to understand the Logos unless they're taught that. Okay? Meanwhile, we're supposed to be making disciples, not just getting people born again and then giving them something to read. Yes, you certainly may.
And when Peter wrote this, probably the only word there was the Old Testament.
That is true. There was the Torah. There were some of Paul's writings that were available. He tells us that evil men wrest his words. Okay, I think that's in 2 Peter, but it wasn't that much later than this. But you're absolutely right. The only thing that was absolutely known to be Scripture at the time was Tanakh. Okay. So anyway, that was up to verse 3, right? If so be that ye have tasted that Yahweh is gracious, to whom coming, as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious, ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house and holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to Elohim by Yeshua HaMashiach. Wherefore also it is contained in the Scripture, Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect and precious, and he that believeth on him shall not be confounded. Unto you, therefore, which believe, he is precious, but unto them which be disobedient, the stone which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner. For those of you that were here this morning, we talked about this a little bit. People could not understand the Jews, the rabbis, could not understand until after the resurrection how all the types and shadows pointed to Messiah. They could not have possibly understood it. Because, number one, had they been able to understand it, then Satan could have understood it, and he would have done something to stop Yeshua from being crucified, or done his best to stop it. Okay? So they could not know that was going on. This is the reason that sometimes we have to see the fulfillment of a prophecy before we even realize that it was a prophecy. And you go, oh my goodness, that was a prophecy. Well, anyway. So, that's an important thing to understand there. Unto you, therefore, which believe, he is precious. But unto them which be disobedient, the stone which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner. And a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient, whereunto also they were appointed. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, an holy nation, a peculiar people, boy are we peculiar, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of Elohim, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Boy, does that sound like Hosea chapter 2. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for Yahweh's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, and unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of Elohim, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of Elohim. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it, if when ye be buffeted for your faults, ye shall take it patiently? But if when ye do well and suffer for it, ye take it patiently, this is acceptable unto Elohim. For even hereunto were we called, were ye called, because Messiah also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that ye should follow in his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, reviled not again, when he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously, who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, being dead to sins, should live unto righteousness, by whose stripes we are healed. For ye were as sheep going astray, but are now returned unto the shepherd and bishop of your souls. The Torah and Tanakh references in there are just, it's astronomical. I couldn't count them all.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Susie.
Well, just verse 25, I did go back to the first chapter. I wanted to just, I'm not even sure why I did that, but anyway, it just gave me some background for the ones, for instance, verses 1 and 2 of 1 Peter, Kephan, emissary of Yeshua Messiah to the chosen, strangers of the dispersion in the various cities there. And so, because the word returned caught my eye, again in verse 25, and so this is another verse for exile and redemption. Oh, and I'd like to make one more comment. We're about verses, let's see, where is it? Well, okay, verses 6 in chapter 2 here, the chief cornerstone that becomes, to those who are disobedient, a stumbling block and a stone of offense. Thinking about what we read in Yeshayahu 60, where we are being the priests and servants of Yahweh, and we who do not stumble at his word or do not find him offensive will be those priests. But those who find him offensive and stumble at him are as the Gentiles. They're outsiders. They are not come into the camp. They are not accepting of his desire.
That's very good. Are there other questions or comments? I don't want to monopolize this. I got a lot of stuff, and I don't want to have to do that.
Well, I'm going to get started then, so I can get my piece in.
You better get your words.
All right. Well, what I'm going to say
is I'm going to hold you off at about 25,000.
Okay, that's about
here,
it.
So that
well, we see that there is two types of teaching that come from Yahweh. Though it's the same, it's just that it's a matter of the condition of the heart that's hearing the instruction. Just as we talked about earlier in this morning's instruction, that those that are not going to be able to really receive the things of Elohim, but those that have hearts of flesh will be able to receive them and apply them. Just as Messiah Yeshua, when he spoke in parables, it said that hearing they may not hear and seeing they may not see, but for you it is given to understand the things of the kingdom. And so for the disciples and those that were willing to draw near to him, he would explain the deeper details of the parables so that they would have instruction. And here, Peter is talking about the milk of the word and how important that instruction is. But as a baby desires it. But some people, you know, to drink milk when you're an adult, or at other times it's just just it's not appropriate. It just doesn't work. And here it talks about that stone of stumbling. That comes from Yeshayahu chapter 28. And in speaking of that, he's addressing people whose hearts are not ready to receive, that are not willing to listen. In verse 8 of chapter 28 of Yeshayahu, or Isaiah, it says, "For all tables shall be covered with vomit, no place without filth. Whom would he teach knowledge? And whom would he make to understand the message? Those weaned from milk, those taken from the breast." And he says, for it is command upon command, command upon command, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, there a little. For with a jabbering lip and with a foreign tongue, he speaks to this people. That means that he's speaking to them Torah, but he's speaking in a way that for them, it's like a jabbering tongue. It's like foreign language. He's giving them Torah, but that because of the condition of their heart, to them it's like speaking a foreign language that means nothing at all. To whom he said, "This is the rest. Give rest to the weary. And this is the refreshing." But they would not hear. See, because their hearts are hard. But the word of Yahweh was to them, command upon command, command upon command, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little, so that they go and shall stumble backward. Now see, they've got it, but he's sharing in the word. But what is their response? Their response to it is that they're going to actually fall into greater depravity, and a result of that, they're going to suffer. They're going to fall backward. They're going to be injured because they're not really receiving it, even though they're hearing it, and be broken and be snared and taken captive. Therefore, the word of Yahweh, to you, men of scorn, who rule this people, who are in Jerusalem, because you have said, "We have made a covenant with death, and with the grave we have effected a vision. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, it does not come to us, for we have made lying our refuge, and under falsehood we have hidden ourselves. Therefore, thus says the Master Yahweh, see, I am laying in Zion a stone for a foundation, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a settled foundation. He who trusts shall not hasten away." Speaking of Messiah, Messiah being that stone. And so for those who will trust in this stone, they will be given instruction. They will be given redemption. But for those who refuse, they will stumble on this stone, and they will be broken and lost.
Can I say one more thing before you talk, Mark? No comment. Just thinking again, Rosanna mentioned the thing about the children and being like newborn babes again from verse 2 and desiring the milk of the word. And Yeshua even rebuked his disciples and he said that you should be like little children to be able to receive the word. And if you cause even one of these little ones to stumble who desires to come after me, you would be better off having been drowned in the sea by a millstone. And there's your stone again that's causing the stumbling, but we can choose to take it on if we're not willing to really humble ourselves before him like children.
Bill says, "Boy, you guys really milked that," talking about the milk of the word. And Ron answers with, "Will someone please wean him?" Okay, enough of the bad jokes. Only I'm allowed to use bad jokes here, okay? Okay, anyway. let's see. Oh, yeah, there's a lot here. "To whom coming as unto a living stone, and precious, chosen of God and precious." And then connect that down to verse 7, where it says, "Unto you, therefore, which believe, he is precious." Okay? This living stone. Yeshua is the living stone. He is also the disallowed, indeed, of men. They want nothing to do with him. He is the stone that is cut out without human hands in Dan chapter 2. If he lands on you, if you land on him, okay, if you give yourself unto him, he gives you life. If he lands on you, he'll grind you to powder. Right? That's what it says in Dan chapter 22, or chapter 2. So that's just a really interesting thing there. Lively stones. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Ron.
Just to kind of amplify what you're saying, the idea of tribulation comes from a stone being placed upon someone as a form of punishment. It was called a tribulum, and it would bring pressure upon them. And so it is that if we don't respond properly to the stone of Messiah Yeshua, our rock, then he will come upon and bring pressure upon our lives.
Very good. A tribulum, huh? Tribulum. See, you taught me something today. That's good. That's really good. I like that. Lively stones. You realize that that's active material in the household of faith. Lively stones. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, the foundation stone, Yeshua, Acts 4:11. Very good. Let's see. You got anything else? Anybody else got anything? Oh, well, we've gone through the whole chapter, so anywhere in the chapter.
Like we said, the living stone. The only way it can be a living stone is when that living stone is built upon him, which we just mentioned was the true foundation. The lively stone partake of the name and life, which is the living stone, like in verse 4, and in 1 Corinthians 3, 10 and 11. So these stones that he's talking about are not just a stone. They're talking about us in this sense, because Yeshua is talked about as a stone or as a rock. So the question here is, what is being built up? That's the question. What is being built up? The spiritual house. It's the abode of the Ruach, which we mentioned in some previous chapters. So we are to be a spiritual temple, and the priest of that temple, hello, we're going to be a priest, you see. And as Yeshua is the only priest in the Brit Hadashah, through which we can draw near to Yahweh, it is a royal priesthood likened unto Melchizedek. So all this fits together here. When you reject, you're rejecting the priesthood. You're rejecting him. And you lose. You don't win. Can't win in this case right here. You cannot win. Because he tells us, you're a chosen generation. You're a peculiar people. You're different from the rest because I have chosen you. And we should show forth within that temple, we should show forth his praises to him.
We should show forth how we're different.
How we're different. That's right. We're there, you know, there's a song called Dare to Be a Daniel and Dare to Stand Alone. That's what we're supposed to be, just like Daniel. Sometimes you think you're all alone in this world. Everybody's coming down on me. Think of Daniel. Think of Daniel. Dare to be a Daniel and dare to stand alone. That's what I have so far through that.
We're being brought not to Mount Zion, Mount Sinai, but we're being brought to Mount Zion in that for the first Israel that came to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, they were given this promise that they too would be a royal, a chosen race, a priesthood, a set-apart nation, a people for a possession, that claim the praises of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. But it has come around. We've been brought not to the pattern, but to the real thing. True high priest, Messiah Yeshua, and better promise, a much better, a better covenant, in that it's built on better promises, in that we are now brought into a place where our flesh is no longer that same, our flesh is the same, but our heart is changed to become a heart of flesh, in that it's softened, whereas for them, their hearts became hard. Now, they have the choice to allow their hearts to be soft, and we have that same choice, but we've been put into a better place because of the Spirit's freedom to work in our hearts and our lives. Yeshua said, it's good that I go away, because if I do, then the Spirit will come, and He will lead us into all truth. And we talked about the importance of truth, and that truth is what's in the Torah. And if it's applied, then it brings about good works, which bring about righteousness and sanctification.
How about it talks about sacrifices.
Oh, I was going to say it doesn't talk about anything, but you said sacrifices. Okay.
It talks about sacrifice.
Yes. Living sacrifice.
It's
spiritual sacrifice.
Spiritual sacrifice. It is important to note that we can never offer anything to Yahweh until we have offered ourselves. 2 Corinthians 8:5. In sacrifice to Him. That's the greatest thing that we can do to start out. Now, the stone of stumbling, it's from Isaiah 8:14. It's not merely that these people stumbled, but in their prejudice were offended. But their stumbling implies that the judicial punishment of the reception of Messiah is there, and hurting themselves in stumbling over the cornerstone, as in Jeremiah 13:6 and Dan 11:19. Of what did they stumble over? Of the Word. They stumbled over the Word. And I say, to wit, they are giving up to the fruit of their own ways. They're rotting because they were stumbling over Torah, over their own Word. Even the Jews, they stumble over their own Word. They don't see it. They miss it. They miss it altogether. And all we have to do is go back to the prodigal. Ephraim left. When he comes back, the father's going out to meet him and give him the ring and the shoes and make him part of the royal priesthood. And the other son, Judah, sitting out there, I've been with you all this time, but I'm not coming to the banquet, you see. So he stumbles over the Word too, you know. And until he comes into the banquet, you can stay outside and look at the lights, but the merriment's taking place on the inside. And he's in outer darkness, basically.
Now, isn't it because of the condition of the heart? You have the Torah. Now, one's initially rejected the Torah, but then the second son, or let's say the older son that stays with the father, he has a Torah with him, but he's not responding to it with, you know, a heart of tenderness, of compassion. But the son that was the prodigal, having gone through hardship, it changed him to where he was tender to the instruction of his father. And we talked about earlier how the animals suffered through this process of bringing the priests into a sanctifying where they would be able to serve in the tabernacle. And here in verse 19 it says, for this is favor, if because of conscience toward Elohim anyone bears up under grief, suffering unrighteously. For what credit is there in enduring a beating when you sin? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure, this finds favor with Elohim. So going through this suffering with humility of heart and mind is a way that brings favor. For this you were called, because Messiah also suffered for us. You know, Messiah himself, he learned obedience through the things that he suffered, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who being reviled did not revile in return, suffering he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. So we too ought to live also in his righteousness.
You know, it talks about disobedience here. Now, does this really make a difference with Yahweh? Not according to Romans 3:3. For what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of Yahweh without effect? The next verse says, God forbid, or Yahweh forgive. Which is the start of verse 1. Yeah, you nuts? What's the matter? Yeah, what's the matter with you? Do you think that makes a difference with him? It doesn't. You want to be disobedient?
You can be disobedient. The difference comes what happens to us,
right,
not what happens to him. Because what you perceive Yahweh to be in your heart is what you are. It's what you are, not what he is, because he never changes. He's always the same. It's how you perceive him that will make the difference.
Okay, go ahead, Phil.
Yeled Yehudi has his hand up, so we want to give him a chance to speak.
Let him in.
So, Yehudi, come to the mic.
Had
some audio trouble. It sounded like you just had a helicopter for a voice. So I don't know what. I'm not sure what the problem was.
It sounded like a Huey going overhead, man.
But we'll give you, I don't know, maybe you can reboot or something, but we'll give you a chance, Mark. You can make a comment, and then Yehudi, you can come back to the mic again.
Okay, I wanted to switch gears over what we were doing before and show you in verse 11. Dearly. Well, thinking about it Hebraically, what's the difference between a stranger and a pilgrim? A pilgrim is you're right. A pilgrim is somebody who's making a journey for a particular reason. But a stranger, in the Hebraic thought, is a Gentile, okay, who has come to live among Israel, okay. So he's a ger, if you will. So he's not just writing to the Gentiles. He's also writing to the pilgrims from Judea who are out in the wilderness, all right, doing whatever it is that they're doing. So it's important to note here that he's not writing to just Gentiles. He's also writing to both houses of Israel, Judah and Ephraim.
Now, earlier in our Exodus portion, you talked about how the strangers that were mentioned there were anyone other than the priesthood, so that no one would be able to partake of the particular food. Never recognized as strangers. So that was even Israelites who recognized the strangers as not being a part of the Aaronic priesthood. So there's, you have to understand what strangers means when it's put in the correct context.
Well, right. It's in different contexts, it can mean different things. That is correct. Strangers in generally is just the word ger. That's the word that was used there, by the way, back there in Exodus. Chapter 29. That's the word that was used there. Strangers was ger. But these were not strangers. These were Israelites. But they were just not. They were strangers to the priesthood. Okay, to the high priesthood, I should say. Because at that point, they were still a royal priesthood, you know. But here they're strangers, dearly beloved, okay, the strangers being Gentile believers and the pilgrims being Jewish believers. That's the way I see it anyway. Other questions or comments?
There's sort of a strange thing taking about it. He said that those being obedient, they were appointed to that. They were appointed to disobedience. So when he says that I make vessels of honor and vessels of dishonor, he chooses to whom he will. And so these people were appointed to this. And I know that in the Christian world this seems like a strange phenomena that he would do such a thing, but the word is very clear that he has done this. Is this a right that he can wrong, a wrong rather that he can right? I think that that's true. And the ones that are chosen of honor is the royal priesthood. That's the royal priesthood. Now, those that were appointed, does that mean that they're unsaved? Not necessarily. It could be those that are not of the royal priesthood. So again, you have to take things into context. You know, they could be without the camp, you see. Now, probably the best example I could give again is the wedding supper. Well, I'm going to the wedding. Some are in the audience, some are the attendants, but only the bride goes into the Holy of Holies, the priesthood, the royal priesthood, you see. So are they there? Yeah, they're all there. But some are appointed for different things because of their obedience and how they perceive Torah and how they study Torah and do what Torah says to do. So this doesn't necessarily mean that these people are gone, you see, but that they're in a different role to play, mainly because Yahweh knows their heart. He knew it beforehand. He knew us before we were born, but he knows everything about us, everything.
Right, but I was thinking about the wedding as well, and thinking about how important at that time the wedding garment would be, because we have the story of the wedding feast, and that the servants were commanded to bring everyone in. And when it came time to be able to celebrate the wedding, the master went around and he noticed there was someone that was there without a wedding garment, and that person was thrown out. So you might be invited in, but when you're there, you better make sure that you've got the wedding garment on.
Yes. Yes, we had a question about the five foolish and the five wise virgins, the 10 virgins, and how it has to do with the wedding feast. Yes, absolutely. They were all virgins. That's right.
There's a lot of stories about them. You have the marriage of Cana.
Many of the stories that are found within the scriptures have to do with the wedding, because it is so important to the understanding of coming into relationship with Yahweh. He wants us to be able to get a good understanding about that. In fact, even in the teaching this morning, we talked a lot about the ketubah and the ketubah, but then also there was another word that was nesuim. Anyway, there are different terms that were used that are important to understanding the Jewish wedding, which brings us into a better comprehension of what it means to be in right relationship with Elohim.
Do we have any idea what the wedding garment is?
It has to do with white robes of righteousness. Therefore, it is that whereupon we are, that by which we are clothed upon by Messiah. That's the wedding garment. That's the righteousness that he gives us, and our obedience there too. In verse 12. I was just looking, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation.
May I read something here from Revelation chapter 19?
Sure, go ahead.
And verse 6, it says, "And I heard as the voice of a great crowd, as the sound of many waters, and as the sound of mighty thunder, saying, Hallelujah, for Yahweh El Shaddai reigns. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him praise, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride, or wife, has prepared herself. And to her it was given to be dressed in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteousness of the set apart ones." And then it says, blessed are those who have been called to the marriage supper of the Lamb.
If you really want to know how the bride's dressed and what she looks like, go to the Songs of Solomon. It has it all. It's all in there. It tells you his feeling towards her and how she looked and everything like that, and how she was adorned and dressed. And it's right there. That's basically where the whole outfit is.
Now, verse 12 again. Having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. We are seen by the world as evil people. We are seen by the world as evil people. And because they don't hold to the because we don't hold to the pagan traditions that they hold to. But we did nothing unlawful, and so we are seen as being good people. Okay? By our good works. Now, what are our good works? Our good works are our obedience to Yahweh in following His Torah. It's where it says, submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, for Yahweh's sake. That's talking about submitting yourself to every ordinance of man, to every ordinance of man that doesn't violate Yahweh's Torah. And you can see that in verse 19, for this is thankworthy if a man for conscience toward Elohim endure grief, suffering wrongly. Okay? You're suffering wrongly because you're doing what Yahweh told you to do. And you're obeying the law of the land as best you can in accordance with Torah. If it goes against Torah, you are not to follow the law of the land. Okay? So, and this is one of those verses, verse 13, is one of those verses like Romans chapter 13 and verses 1 through 7 that are taken so far out of context. They do not understand that we need to be obedient to Torah. We need to be obedient to Elohim first. And then we obey what laws man passes that do not go against that. And if the law of man goes against that, then we get to disobey that law and suffer the consequences of being disobedient to that law. And do it joyfully. Okay? And Paul and Peter gets into that deeper in other parts of the thing about suffering wrongfully in the next chapter, actually. Other questions or comments?
Just that after 11 and so forth, it's from here on to the end of the chapter, the exhortation here from here on is based upon our sufferings and to glory in those sufferings for Him and for His sake. It talks about honest conversation, it talks about good works, it talks about being to submit and not to use our salvation for maliciousness. We're supposed to honor Yahweh, love the brotherhood, fear Yahweh, honor the king, be servants in subjection. And as Yahweh suffered, so may we. Because Yahweh did the suffering doesn't mean that we're not going to suffer. So if you read this down through here, it just tells you how we're supposed to be. It says honor Yahweh. Down here later it says fear Yahweh, honor the king. Who's the king? Yeshua. You see, honor Him. Honor Him in your good works and the things that you do, your loving kindness and everything that you do. This is what this is leading up to, you know. And that's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be servants in subjection. But servants in subjection to the king.
Yes, right. Servant in subjection to the king, Yeshua, first.
That's right.
But that doesn't mean that we're not to be in subjection to the king.
Oh.
As long as His law doesn't violate Torah.
That's true. Right. That is true. Okay. So there's a fine line there, you see.
Well, yeah,
not what we think, it's what the Word says.
This gets to be taken both literally,
that's right,
what's written there about the king on earth, and
right,
also spiritually as the King
right.
Yeshua.
Yep, that's it.
When you speak about the laws, Mark addressed that earlier in regards to the laws being put upon the people to bring the people into condemnation or guilt. We think about what Yeshua said when he spoke to the Pharisees and the woes, because they laid such heavy burdens upon the people. And they were basically building a fence around the Torah in a way that would cause the people to not really grasp the heart of the Torah, but be forced to keep a set of rules that would put them in a place of self-condemnation because of their inability to be able to keep it according to the way in which the Pharisees had prescribed it. And so we do have to be careful about being in subjection to the governing authorities. Yes, in the basic things that they've called us to do in regards to righteousness, then yes, we should keep it. But we need to be very careful, too, that the laws that have been imposed upon us are not laws designed to just bring us into a place of being the manipulated.
You know, when you put a hedge around the word, you have the same problem before the Reformation that you had back here. The people didn't know what was going on. They weren't even allowed, or they couldn't read. They didn't have the word. They took it away from them. They took the word away from them. They were starved spiritually, and they didn't understand everything. But when the word came into light, then they rebelled. Not because they were rebellious people, but they were rebelling because they saw the word for the first time in the true light, and they wanted to follow the word. Then they became the evil ones. Same thing's happening today.
Right, I agree with you, Bill. The Reformation is a result of the governing authorities, which were basically the Catholic Church, seeking to be able to control the people, and so the people weren't even being exposed to the truth of the word. Instead, they were being exposed to a system of rules and regulations that were not leading the people into truth, but into darkness and into, basically, like I said, controlled situations. And the same situation existed at the time of our forefathers that founded this nation. They were considered revolutionaries or rebels to the crown because they were not following in complete submission, but they established that they were not going to be subjected to rules that were in violation to biblical law. They even actually cited biblical violations for their reason for being able to stand up against the rules or the governmental authorities predicated upon their understanding of the truth of the scriptures, that they would stand against the evil manipulative laws that were laid down by an abusive authority.
Well, we have the same conditions today in a lot of the sect, a lot of the so-called religious people. If you go to this certain church of God and you go to this certain church of God, and they're different in some way. Well, they've got it over here, but they don't. But these people say, well, we got it here, and they don't over here. And you have to dress a certain way. Some places you can't wear a tie. You can't do that. Where is that found in Scripture?
Exactly.
Are we building fences around Torah again?
I was talking to Mark about this earlier this week, because he was mentioning that we were together. And I said, it was so liberating for me and my family to come out of the church. I mean, even though we were just under grace, just under grace supposedly, within the church, there was so much manipulation by the governing authorities. I mean, you could outstand a certain set of rules and regulations that were upon his mind or within the denomination that would be those laws that would be, which they would determine, which would be the most heinous, when actually the scriptures themselves didn't delineate them in such a manner.
All I know is that I don't drink, and I don't chew, and I don't go with girls who do. And you know what? None of that is sinful, okay? Drinking, smoking, chewing tobacco, there's nothing in Scripture that says that that's a sin. Okay? But you know what? My body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, I am not going to defile it. Well, you know what? That's fine. But don't make it a sin for for you to not do it, and don't make it a sin for me to not do what you do. Okay? That's the drunkenness is a sin.
That's right.
Drinking the alcohol is not. Okay? Yeah, drunkenness is definitely commanded.
Being a glutton. It tells you not to be a glutton. Gluttonous is wrong. But
yeah, it says not to make your God your belly.
Yeah.
Or make your belly your God.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So
and that's what that is. It's idolatry.
We come back here and we talk about the priests and everything, the priesthood and what they did, and they were doing this and they were doing that. And the very preacher that's preaching that is doing the very same thing under another sheep's clothing, a different kind of clothing. And they're making up rules. Whatever
they go. Be careful
now,
because we all do the same thing now.
I know.
Make sure you're not preaching to...
I could be preaching to the choir. Yeah, we're sort of meddling a little bit
could
here.
Could be preaching to ourselves, too, and not even
knowing
it.
That is true.
Okay.
I mean, I believe that, because we can be destructive to ourselves and our self-righteousness and say, well, why would they do that, or why do they don't do this, or something like that? And I have to constantly remind myself, you know what? I have enough problems
looking
at...
Why do disciples not wash their hands before they eat?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you know, you can set up laws and boundaries that you're going to choke out the Torah. People say, I'm glad I have grace. I don't have to worry about the laws. And that's exactly what has happened today. That is exactly what has happened today. I mean, I can verify that from people that I worked with said, well, I'm a New Testament Christian. And I says, you are? I says, yeah. He said, all them 613 laws, he says, we don't have to abide by them. I said, well, that's good. He looked at me and I said, yeah, I'm glad to hear that, because we can commit murder, adultery. Well, no, you can't do that. I said, now, wait a minute. You just told me we don't have to worry about that. But I said, how many to-dos and not-to-dos are in the New Testament? Well, I don't know. I said, well, there's over 1,050. And some of them are tougher. Mm-hmm. He made them stronger because we were supposed to be enlightened. So, you can't use that. You can't use that. Thou shall not. You know? The problem we have with the word is that little word, if. If my people... If you obey, if you do this, you know, that's how we live. That's part of life. That's it.
You're right, Bill. We need to live in the liberation of walking in Torah by the leading of the Spirit with the abiding presence of Messiah Yeshua, and not give ourselves into the place of being controlled by one man who's laying down his convictions over a congregation or even a denominational set of rules and regulations. We need to be careful to guard our hearts and to watch, make sure that we are walking according to the Torah as the Spirit is leading us. Now, for some, their understanding of walking in the Torah may not be the same place that I am, but it's not for me to condemn them, even though you know, there are things that I say, oh, well, this is right here. You should be doing this. It's up to the Holy Spirit to bring conviction on some of these issues.
You know, one of the examples that I think that we could probably use is women lib. We've been liberated. We can do that. And you know what? They're gone contrary to the word of Yahweh. One of the greatest things that Yahweh has given to the woman is womanhood and being a mother and raising her children and do it. That's one of the highest honors that she could give a woman. And they're throwing it out because they think, quote, they have to have women live. And everybody goes along with it. They don't say...
Bill, it's a part of the system whereby, see, if you get the woman liberated, so to speak, well, actually, basically, you're putting into her bondage where she's having to carry a job or different responsibilities than the children. So who takes care of the children then? Basically, they've been putting them into institutions, and the institutions of government want to control the children at younger and younger ages. So they want to get their hands on our children as soon as possible so they can indoctrinate them again in such a way that they can control them to become their subservience.
That's why the Catholic Church wants her children from grade 1 to grade 8 for sure. They figure if they have them that long, they've got them. And that is a fact. If you want to go to a secular school after that, go
ahead.
We've already got you.
They didn't get me. They had me from grade 1 to grade... from grade 1 to grade 7.
But the norm is...
It's that eighth year. That's what it is.
The norm is grade 1 through grade 8. And then from then on, they feel that they have you.
Okay. Just to switch gears a little bit.
Okay.
Here we are in verse 21. For even hereunto were ye called. That's all of us. Because Messiah also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that ye should follow his steps. Do we not get this every time we do a Torah service or a Sabbath service here, when we sing Torah Walk, which is Psalm 2 or 1 John 2:6, where it says, "He that saith he abideth in him ought himself also so to walk, even as he walked," talking about Yeshua. So, is that not exactly the truth? So, how did Yeshua walk? How did Yeshua walk?
He kept Torah.
He kept Torah. That's exactly right. Okay. Well, we got other questions or comments on chapter 2 of the book of 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 2. Anything in Pal Talk, Phil? Anybody else got anything here? I'm not seeing any hands. I'm not seeing anybody reaching for a mic. Okay. Then I'm going to call our midrash complete. We're done for now. It's took us, about 2 hours and 40 minutes or something like that to get through this one. We had some really good insights given by lots of different people, including Yehudi in Pal Talk. Thanks for being here, buddy. Make sure you stick around. We'd like to hear from you every week. You have good insights. We'd like to hear from everybody else out there, too. Please don't be chicken. Please don't be afraid. We don't bite or nothing. Remember something, man. Scripture is like a multifaceted diamond, a perfectly cut multifaceted diamond with the light shining up through it, the light being the truth of God. And we're all standing all around that thing, and we see light differently from each of our different perspectives. We need to get it all, or we're never going to understand it all. So we need to hear from everybody. Okay, well anyway, we're done for tonight. Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. We'll see you next week, 10:30-ish. 10:30-ish. Hopefully Mark can get here on time.
Very-ish.
Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.